While the remaining guns of Exeter were firing and scoring hits, heroic actions were going on in many parts of the ship. Even as 11-inch and 6-inch shells were bursting in and through the ship, killing many, damage control parties were fighting fires and throwing overboard smoldering cordite charges. Men trying to flood compartments, swamping with petrol from burning aircraft. Magazines were being flooded when on the point of blowing up. Another 11-inch shell destroyed the other forward turret, and now only the one after turret remained, compelling the ship to swing hard to port to allow the guns to bear on target. But still she came on, guns blazing. She was still firing and hitting Grass Bay, but at 0645, this wonderful ship had taken as much punishment as any ship could take. But in the last moments of her great and gallant fight, one of her shells scored a direct hit in the middle of the giant superstructure in the bridge control, which did great damage, partially disrupting her gunnery control. But then, a further shell from Graf's Bay destroyed Exeter's one remaining after turret. Bell now had nothing left to attack with. At least he decided he had one missile. An 8,000-ton projectile traveling at 30 knots, his own ship. His plan, to ram the enemy. But Grass Bay was also having a bad time, being shelled from three directions at once and receiving much damage. Meanwhile, from the air, the pilots Lewin and Kearney could watch and report every movement of the German ship. At one point, much to their dismay, they saw Graf Spee's aircraft being made ready for takeoff in order to shoot them down. Then, to their relief, they saw a salvo of shells from the British ships hit the catapult deck and destroy it and the aircraft. All this time, the other two cruisers, Ajax and Achilles, had been hammering away at the enemy with their smaller 6-inch guns, but also receiving much damage. Shells from the German brought down Ajax's mast and put four guns out of action, with many casualties. Achilles also received critical damage, with a direct hit on the control tower, killing many there. While Captain Bell in Exeter was still deciding on his course of action to ram Graf's Bay, coincidentally, two other things happened almost at the same time, which altered the whole course of events. Commodore Harwood, realizing that his light cruisers were no match for the mighty guns of the pocket battleship, decided he would break off the engagement to conserve ammunition and just stalk the enemy from a distance. But at the same time, Captain Langsdorff decided that with many of his crew killed and his gunnery control damaged, that he had had enough, and he turned his ship away, made smoke, and began to withdraw. By now, Exeter was virtually a helpless wreck, down by the bows, listing, and on fire. And so at 0730, with her many dead and dying and her wounded, a total of 84 casualties, her forward turrets a mass of flame, and her superstructure a devil's scrapyard, on instructions from Harwood, Exeter turned away, headed south on the long 1,200 miles haul to the safety of Port Stanley in the Falklands. Now began the long chase, with Ajax and Achilles hanging on to the retreating ship, with Graf's Bay repeatedly lashing out with her rear turret triple 11-inch guns. During this engagement, below decks in Graf's Bay, where Captain Dove and the other 60-odd other captured masters and officers of sunken merchant ships were confined, they had listened with alarm to the firing of the guns immediately above them and to the crash of the British shells hitting the ship. Down there, in such a confined space, the noise was shattering. While they were thrilled that rescue might be at hand, they also realized that if Graf's Bay was sunk, they would sink with her, like rats in a trap. Each time a British shell hit above them, they raised a cheer. But was it adding to their destruction? One of the British shells, landing just above them, cut a hole in the deck plating, and were able to glimpse some of the action. On the bridge of Grass Bay, Captain Langsdorff was in a dilemma. He realized that for him, it was decision time. 36 of his crew had been killed and 60 wounded. His gunnery control was damaged, and he was running short of oil fuel. Ahead to the west, at Montevideo, lay the German supply ship, the SS Tacoma, with a full supply of oil waiting. Behind him were the two British cruisers driving him west, refusing to withdraw to allow him to turn and head back into the South Atlantic, where the other supply ship, Altmark, was waiting. More important, there was always the probability that beyond those two British cruisers, there were heavy ships of a British battle squadron coming to support. In the event, he opted for Montevideo, and just after midnight of the 14th of October, anchored in the roads, while Ajax and Achilles took up station off the mouth of the estuary. That night, the big cruiser Cumberland arrived from the Falklands, joining Ajax and Achilles to replace the crippled Exeter. Meanwhile, from the Cape of Good Hope, 3,000 miles away, the 18-gun cruisers Dorsetshire and Shropshire headed west at full speed to give further support if Grass Bay should attempt to break out. But it would be 5 days before they arrived. The trap was shutting, but not shut. Meanwhile, down below, the prisoners in Grass Bay listened anxiously as the engine stopped, and they felt the ship drifting quietly on. Moments later, a German lieutenant with sentries appeared and said, "Gentlemen, for you, the war is over. We are now anchored in Montevideo Harbor, and the captain has told me you are to be released tomorrow." Barely able to comprehend the wonderful news, they cheered and clapped and even shook hands with the German guards who had come to release them. Captain Dove was asked to follow one of the sentries, as the captain wished to speak to him in his cabin. When Captain Dove arrived, he was shocked at the change in the man. In the last few hours, the earlier humor and confidence had been replaced by sadness and care. He had been wounded in the face, and his right arm was in a sling. But he had nothing but praise for the men of HMS Exeter. "When you fight brave men like that," he said, "you cannot feel enmity. You only want to shake hands with them. You English are hard. You do not know when you are beaten." The Exeter was beaten, but would not know it. Then, holding out his injured hand, he shook hands with Captain Dove. In the conversation that followed, Langsdorff was convinced that British capital ships were approaching the Uruguayan coast. Some hours later, Captain Dove and his colleagues were mustered on the quarter deck, close to the 36 coffins of the Grass Bay's dead, and after turning and saluting the coffins, they walked quickly down the gangway and into the tug waiting to take them ashore. Now began a diplomatic row. International law demanded that no warship belonging to a belligerent power should stay in port for more than 24 hours without being interned. But Langsdorff required far longer than that to have the repairs done. Although Grass Bay was still seaworthy, she had 27 shell holes in her, with all her kitchens and stores shut away and her fighting efficiency badly damaged. The Nazi minister in Montevideo argued that a 15-day stay would be required to complete repairs. However, the British minister, Mr. Millington Drake, protested that under international law, Grass Bay could only stay 24 hours. After considerable argument, the Uruguayan government granted a stay of 72 hours on the understanding that should the time limit be exceeded, then Grass Bay would be interned. As the hours passed, apprehension grew as to the outcome, especially in London. Churchill signalled, "We should prefer that Grass Bay be interned if possible, as any further battle with needless bloodshed must never be sought." However, the BBC came to the aid of the government by transmitting propaganda reporting that a number of British ships, including the Renown and the aircraft carrier Ark Royal, were closing in towards the River Plate to destroy Grass Bay should she break out. In actual fact, no British capital ship was within 3,000 miles, and it would have taken 5 days to reach Montevideo. But the announcement had the desired effect, for it confirmed Langsdorff's conviction that his battleship would stand no chance against such odds. The Uruguayan government's firm stand on the Neutrality Act brought dire threats from Adolf Hitler's screaming telephone demands. Despite this, the game of bluff and saber-rattling was up. Eventually, Langsdorff went ashore to consult with the German minister. There he sent off his official report, which read as follows. Strategic position off Montevideo. Besides the cruisers and destroyers, Ark Royal and Renown. Close blockade at night. Escape into open sea and breakthrough to home waters hopeless. Request decision on whether the ship should be scuttled in the plate or whether internment is preferred. This report brought an urgent conference between Hitler, Admiral Raeder, and General Jodl, and this reply was sent. Attempt to extend time in neutral waters. Fight your way through to Buenos Aires if possible. No internment in Uruguay. Attempt effective destruction if ship is scuttled. But the Uruguay government were adamant no extension would be given. At 8 o'clock that evening, Grass Bay moved slowly out into the estuary and the demolition crew transferred to the supply ship. At 8:54, the great ship was rocked by enormous explosions as the bottom was ripped out of her, and she sank into the mud of the main channel to burn for 3 days and three nights. 3 days later, December the 20th, in Buenos Aires, Argentina, Langsdorff, a very sad man, sat down and wrote a final letter. I can now only prove by my death that the fighting services of the Third Reich are ready to die for the honor of the flag. I alone bear the responsibility for scuttling the pocket battleship Graf's Bay. I am happy to pay with my life for any possible reflection on the honor of the flag. I shall face my fate with firm faith in the cause and future of the nation and of my Führer. That night, Captain Hans Langsdorff wrapped himself in the flag of the Imperial German Navy under which he had fought in the First World War and shot himself. But it wasn't the Nazi flag. While in Germany, the notorious propagandist and liar, Lord Hohol, was steadily broadcasting to the world that the British cruiser Exeter was lying at the bottom of the sea, that ship was safely in harbour at Port Stanley, licking her wounds, but preparing to go home to a grateful nation. Some days later, the cruisers Dorsetshire and Shropshire arrived at Port Stanley, and Captain Bissett of Shropshire stood at the top of the gangway leading to Exeter's deck, removed his cap, stood to attention, and said to the quartermaster and the lieutenant, "Gentlemen, may I have the honour to come aboard your gallant ship?" On February the 14th, Exeter arrived at Plymouth. The grassy slopes of the Hoe were covered with thousands of people shouting, cheering, and frantically waving to the blackened, charred, tangled scrapyard of steel that moved slowly along into the Hamoaz, followed by a group of important people in the Commander-in-Chief's barge. As they moved into the area of the dockyard, sirens hooted, cranes dipped in salute, and workmen banged their hammers in an hysterical welcome. As the gangway dropped to the dock wall at Devonport, a smiling, chubby-faced, bowler-hatted figure, cigar-armed, hauled himself aboard. Mr. Winston Churchill, the first Sea Lord, had arrived to present his congratulations to the captain and crew of HMS Exeter.